listener production.
Hello, welcome to The Briefing. Katrina Blau is here with you, and on today's show...
There is reason they wanted me.
Why me?
Charlotte, there are worse fates than marrying the King of England.
But are there? We're talking about the new Netflix show, Queen Charlotte. It is currently the number one show on the streaming service. It is a spin-off of the very popular Bridgerton series, and it gives the backstory of the British Queen Charlotte. Now, this show has been sparking a wee bit of conversation on social media because in this series, Queen Charlotte is black.
Features that are allegedly proof of Charlotte's African heritage, for example, very full lips, for example, and quite protuberant eyes. That's a feature of George as much as Charlotte, and no one is claiming that George has black ancestry.
So if Queen Charlotte was the first black queen, it means her descendants, including Queen Victoria and Queen Elizabeth II, have African ancestry. So Jan Fran's going to be diving into that briefing topic today. But first, let's get into today's headlines with Antoinette Latouf. It is Monday, the 15th of May.
You may have remembered some pretty disturbing scenes in Melbourne where there were neo-Nazi salutes, and you perhaps were thinking, oh my gosh, it's 2023, is this crap still happening? Well, it is, because now two men have been charged over their involvement in a clash between neo-Nazis and anti-racism protesters, again, in Melbourne, this time on Saturday. So dressed in black and covering their faces, around 30 neo-Nazis gathered in protest. Well, they were protesting against immigration, and there were a group of anti-fascist protesters. They were a much larger group. They clashed, and police had to use capsicum spray and make several arrests to calm the violence.
Yeah, this worried me. The last protest, which was, you know, not even 2 months ago, that was an anti-transgender protest, which neo-Nazis kind of crashed outside Parliament House in Melbourne. So this one, they say, is in opposition to new migrants, which they say will further exacerbate the housing crisis and ethnic replacement of white Australians in their own suburbs and towns. It is really disturbing rhetoric.
To be honest, it is disturbing, but what's most disturbing is that it echoes Peter Dutton's reply speech to the budget, because these are the sentiments, and this was the kind of xenophobia that Peter Dutton was espousing after it was announced of a return of international students and a large intake of migrants. He came back going, well, this is bad for housing, this is bad for Australians. Next minute, you've got neo-Nazis saying the same thing.
Well, as some Australian families struggle to make ends meet, data from the ABS shows just how expensive the cost of education has now become as well. According to the stats, high school fees have almost tripled since 2003, with prices going up quicker than most of our household bills, while the cost of preschool, primary and university has more than doubled in that time. A lot of people are wondering, where's all this money going? Apparently, teachers' salaries make up three-quarters of the cost of education. We can't really say that we don't want teachers to get paid more. I still don't think they're paid enough. But yeah, my brother works for the Smith family, and he has to allocate charity funds to families who can't afford to send their kids to school. And he says the kids that can't afford, you know, new uniforms and the equipment that all the other kids have, they get bullied, which is so heartbreaking.
It's so interesting, Katrina, that you talked about op shops, because I came across an old photo of me at school. It was a school class photo, and I'm maybe in year 4 or 5, and I'm wearing a uniform from the op shop, which isn't actually the school uniform. It's just one that kind of looks like it, that my it's all we could afford. But what's been happening in recent years is just creating a larger divide between the haves and the have-nots. And I think just school needs to be an equalizer. It needs to be a place where students mix irrespective of socioeconomic background. And in addition to these costs going up of education, there's been a shift from public education to private and independent and Catholic schools. And I just think that's a real worry, because it's entrenching that divide, and that's not going to yield good things for Australia moving forward.
The National Road Safety Strategy is in question. It is meant to stop road deaths by 2030, but road deaths keep rising. They've risen by about 10% since 2021. WA is the state that's had the biggest jump in the 12 months to March this year, with an additional 26 deaths. Victoria has 23. More than 1,200 lives have been lost nationally in the year to April. But I guess amongst all this, these horrible stats, there's a tiny bit of light. New South Wales and the Northern Territory have not seen an increase in the past year. Gosh, what a conundrum! What do you do?
Not seeing an increase for New South Wales and Northern Territory, I mean, that is good news, but it's still not halving it as the strategy sets out to achieve. So this strategy was announced in 2020, and the Australian Automobile Association, they've come out with a pretty scathing assessment. Well, they're going as far as questioning the government's commitment to reducing road trauma at all, arguing that this needs to be completely scrapped and something else put in its place to save lives. The results of the Turkish presidential election are rolling in right at the moment, and it could signal the end of Recep Tayyip Erdogan's 20-year tenure in power. So Erdogan has been responsible for making Turkey more authoritarian and has moved the country closer in diplomatic ties to Russia. If his rival Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu wins, it could mean Republican People's Party takes power. Kılıçdaroğlu says he vows to restore democracy and bring what he says Turkey into the light.
So a lot of people who've been analysing voting patterns in Turkey say that a lot has shifted since the devastating earthquake occurred, and it was really that botched rescue attempt that was staged by the government that made a lot of younger voters turn off Erdogan. So, yeah, I think it'll be so fascinating to see this shift in results and the impact that the earthquake in particular had.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that's really challenging the nation is inflation. Last year, it hit 85%. It's currently around 44%. So people are really struggling on a day-to-day basis. And depending on how this goes, and if it does swing to the more progressive party, that will have pretty big geopolitical implications, because a change in leader would shift that balance between Europe, the US, the Middle East, and, of course, Russia.
And the future of Australia competing in Eurovision is up in the air, with no SBS broadcast deal locked in for the coming years. So Aussie band Voyager got through to the grand final. They even got into the top 10, but they couldn't get the win. They made it to number 9. Pretty great effort, though. Sweden's Loreen took out this year's song contest again, while Aussie singer Andrew Lambrow, who represented Cyprus, came in at 12. The show was hosted by the UK this year on behalf of war-torn Ukraine. There was even a bit of a feature from Princess Kate playing on the piano. Ukraine won last year, of course. I don't know that many people who watch Eurovision, but it still did pretty well in the ratings, Antoinette. SBS got some pretty good figures for it. So I think there still must have been a lot of Eurovision parties going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a little, like you, a little bit surprised to learn that it rated quite well among the top 10 shows over the weekend. Look, I don't know music that well, probably don't know parties that well either, but I do know that Australia, I know basic geography, Australia is not in Europe, but it doesn't mean that we're not successful when we enter Eurovision. We've made it into the top 10 on 4 of our 7 previous appearances, and only once since we joined Eurovision as a competitor in 2015 have we failed to make the finals. So I reckon if you're happy to keep ignoring geography, there's going to be a bunch of people who will be pretty disappointed if we don't find a broadcast partner for next year.
Hello, my lady. Are you in need of assistance of some kind?
If you must know, I'm trying to climb over the garden wall.
Whatever for?
You refuse to help a lady in distress.
I refuse when she's trying to go over a wall so that she does not have to marry me.
Hello, Charlotte.
Your Majesty.
To you, I'm George.
Queen Charlotte is one of the most popular shows on Netflix right now. It is a fictionalized retelling of the story of the real Queen Charlotte, who was the wife of the British monarch King George III. This was between 1761 and 1818. Queen Charlotte was many things. Ruler of Britain, mother of 15 children, kangaroo aficionado. But was she black? Because that's how she's depicted in the Netflix series. And what is interesting is that some historians reckon that there might be a possibility that perhaps maybe she just could have been possibly. But as you're about to hear, that does not solid evidence make. Charlotte has a fascinating story, but African heritage is not likely to be a part of it. So let's dig into that with Cindy McCreary. She is a historian who specialises in, among other things, you guessed it, 18th century British history. Cindy, thanks so much for joining us on The Briefing. Let's start with what we know about the real Queen Charlotte.
Queen Charlotte was German. She was a German Protestant princess, and that's hugely important for understanding why she becomes the wife of the British King George III. It wasn't to do with her personality, her looks, even her youth. It was a dynastic decision that was very much in keeping with the Hanoverian monarchs who were on the British throne at the time. They wanted Protestant princesses to become queens, and they particularly liked German princesses because the Hanoverians themselves were originally a German dynasty. So it ticked all the boxes for George III. It is true that she was young, and it is true that they fell in love, but that was a long-term process, not something that happened immediately.
And what do we know about her as a person?
So Charlotte is a very complex figure. And I guess I want to say that, like every human being, there are many facets to her. On the one hand, she was an incredibly devoted wife and mother. And I think it's fair to say that among the queen consorts of Great Britain, she was one of the most devoted to supporting the monarch and supporting the nation. The other thing about Charlotte that's important to understand is that she was deeply religious. That was very important to her. And she was a very private person. She had a lot of interests. She was interested in science. She was interested in music. She was interested in art. And she was a great patron, which means that she, through her role as queen, was able to sponsor really important scientific, artistic, and musical endeavors in her period. And we owe a lot to that. The other point to make about her, however, was that it, certainly in later life, she becomes a figure of mockery and indeed criticism for her apparent greed. And indeed, there's a lot of satirists and critics who claim that she is really egging her husband on to gain diamonds from India. This is a time when Britain is ruling India, not as a colony, but as through a commercial trading company, the East India Company. And in the late 1780s and 90s, Charlotte is often the butt of a lot of satires that say she's just out for diamonds and all she cares about is money. She's also pilloried, on the other hand, for being overly frugal. She's seen as someone who, like her husband, prefers very plain living. She and her husband, who is known as Farmer George, live simply. And increasingly, her life of simplicity is contrasted with the luxury, the extravagance of her eldest son, the Prince of Wales, who will become George IV. So she's a very complex figure who's seen in different facets by people in 18th century Britain.
So in the series Queen Charlotte, this is, you know, it's a hugely popular series on Netflix. Obviously, it's a spin-off of Bridgerton. And, you know, the makers are very clear to say this is a fictionalised retelling of the life of Queen Charlotte. In the series, she's portrayed as being black. And that sparked a lot of interest and a lot of commentary, you know, principally on social media around the, I guess, the ethnic origins of the real Queen Charlotte. What can you tell us about that? Because there's some historians who believe that she might have black ancestry.
There is some suggestion by some historians that Queen Charlotte may have had African ancestry. But the evidence for that actually goes back to an individual who was around in, I think, the 11th century. And keep in mind that Charlotte is born in 1744 in the 18th century. So that's a very distant African ancestor. Mm. But the other point to make is that the way that people are described in this period in the 18th century, their concepts of race are very different than what they are today. So people don't see race in the 18th century as based on a distinct scientific difference of people's background DNA. They understand it more in cultural terms. And I think that's really important, that Charlotte is not understood by people in her own day as what we would understand to be Black. Yes, there are some comments made on her complexion, which is somewhat sallow. If you look at a lot of engravings of George, who's also got German ancestry, he also appears with some of the features that are allegedly proof of Charlotte's African heritage. For example, very full lips, for example, and quite protuberant eyes. That's a feature of George as much as Charlotte, and no one is claiming that George has Black ancestry.
Just back on that point, just because you're described in a certain way, and there have been descriptions of Queen Charlotte that might lead people to believe or might sound like they're descriptions of people of African ancestry in terms of what the size of her lips looked like or what the colour of her skin might have looked like. Can you just talk us through some of the descriptions that have been attributed to Queen Charlotte over the years?
My feeling as a historian is that there's really not much evidence here, either of her African heritage, other than possibly in the very far distant past. But more importantly, people at the time didn't see her as African. Yes, they may have said that her skin was somewhat sallow and that she was not particularly beautiful, but that didn't mean that they thought she was African. So I think that's a huge liberty that the show is taking. And I must say, as a historian, I think it's super dangerous.
Yeah, I think we should all just bear that in mind. This is a fictionalized retelling, and they're very, very clear about that.
You know what? I don't think they are clear.
Okay,
may I just say?
Right, yeah.
They say that this is a fiction based on fact. I think this is a fiction based on fantasy. And I think it's a dangerous fiction. And I think that we need to be super careful about thinking about when you make choices like this, what are the consequences? And what, by this retelling of history, what does that do to the actual history? And what are the consequences of that? I think this is super dangerous.
Expand on that for me for a second. When you say super dangerous, why?
Because this is a fantasy that in the 18th century in Britain, Black people were accepted, that they managed to have access to status, to wealth, and that there was no such thing as slavery. There was no such thing as Britain's incredible investment in the slave trade and in businesses that benefited from the slave trade. And that somehow this young king and queen are the reason that Britain eventually in the 19th century does push for the abolition of the slave trade. What that means is that people are treated to this idea that really the stories that matter are the stories of the rich and powerful and the entitled. And we lose a sense that ordinary people's lives matter, not just ordinary Black people's lives, but ordinary white people. This is a show that really fantasizes and fetishizes the lives of the titled, of people who are in the 1%. We don't need more fantasies about the 1%. We need more histories and more shows that talk about the experiences of ordinary people. So as a historian, I feel like this is just reinforcing a sense that only rich, titled people matter. And as a historian, that is such a wasted opportunity.
You're coming at it from a historian, but I guess the makers of the show would be coming at it from the point of view of a creative and saying that, you know, this is sort of subverting the genre of what people are generally used to seeing when there's shows about the 16th, 17th, 18th century. It's sort of a subversion of that, and they're taking creative license with that. And I mean, I think that to some extent they have been quite clear about the creative license that they've taken and the reasons why they're doing that. So I guess they have a right to be creative, don't they?
I think it's dangerous, though, when you're conflating history and fiction. If it was the Bridgerton novels where they're not talking about actual historical figures and events, I think that's fine. But when you're talking about British history and that what I think is a much more interesting and complex story, I just think there are opportunities. And I must disagree. This is about a fantasy version of the past that is absolutely based in a capitalist view of wealth and status is important. And I do think that that's, yes, it's creative. Do they have the right to do it? Of course. But this is about chasing profits. This is not about telling the truth. This is not about doing anything that I think is responsible. And this is driven by profit, pure and simple.
Wow, you're really not a fan of this show.
I think it's dangerous because I don't think enough people understand the liberties that are being taken. And I do think there's a real conflation. And you say that they make clear that it's fiction, but if people don't know what the fact is, it's very hard for people to really assess what is real and what is not real here.
Right, because I guess there is the show, and you can give as many disclaimers about the show as is possible, but then people are going to talk about the show on social media. They're going to talk about the show in their friendship groups. They're going to talk about the show with people that they know or, you know, their own audiences. And that's where things, I guess, might get slightly confusing.
Well, I just saw some comments. This was the comments, I should say, on the trailers before the show aired. Comments on the trailer. And one of the comments I found deeply poignant. This is going to be wonderful because it shows that we were all kings and queens, not peasants and slaves. Well, That's a fantasy, but that's not history. But what's wrong with showing the lives of peasants and slaves? I understand it's not as beautiful. I understand it's not as fun. But we need to get over any sense of shame that, you know, maybe not all of us were descended from kings and queens. There's nothing wrong with being an ordinary person. And I just want those stories to be told.
Mm. Why did she like kangaroos so much?
Well, she was very interested in science. And as you may know, Sir Joseph Banks, who accompanies Cook on his first voyage to the Pacific in Australia in 1770, understands. Banks is a player and he completely understands the need to get the king and queen on side. So he makes sure that some of the most exotic animals, Australian animals, are given as gifts to the queen. Charlotte becomes really fascinated with the kangaroo. And like many scientists in England at the time, they're fascinated by this mammal, which is also has its baby in a pouch. And she's very curious about that.
Mm.
And we know that she raised a whole, you know, flock or herd of kangaroos herself and was really delighted by them.
Okay. Your advice to somebody watching the show and being really interested in the history and wanting to talk about it with people that they know or maybe even their audiences on social media, what would it be?
Watch the show, fine, but also read the history, right? We're getting a lot of good history now on consorts, on the queens in this period. So there's a new volume published by Palgrave Macmillan. There's also earlier work published by Clarissa Campbell Orr, who's one of the great scholars of Queen Charlotte. Queen Charlotte is a very important historical figure, and there's lots of great and interesting stories to learn. So look at the watch the show if you will, but also read the history. And I would also, my also top tip would be have a look online at the British Museum. Look at the caricatures of Queen Charlotte because they're fascinating and they're really lively renditions of a queen that I think many people won't be familiar with.
That was Associate Professor Cindy McCreary there talking about the real Queen Charlotte. I guess the takeaway is, well, you're probably going to watch the TV show and not read the history because who can blame you? Who has time? But with all of these things, it's probably pertinent just to, you know, take it with a pinch of salt. And if you're not sure about something, don't say it on social media.
Listener.